The mid-century convocation of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology has moved into its second day, and the speaker for tonight's session is Harold E. Stassen, now president of the University of Pennsylvania. At the same meeting, former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, who last evening addressed this gathering, will accept an honorary MIT lectureship. And now, WHDH takes you to the Boston Garden for the introduction to Mr. Stassen's speech.
From Boston Garden in Boston, Massachusetts, we present the final General Assembly of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Mid-Century Convocation. The address to be delivered by the Honorable Harold E. Stassen, President of the University of Pennsylvania, the appointment of the Right Honorable Winston Churchill as Honorary Lecturer, and the presentation to Mr. Churchill from the students of MIT. The Chairman of the Assembly is Dr. Carl T. Compton, Chairman of the Corporation of MIT. Included in the stage assembly at this final general assembly of the MIT Mid-Century Convocation are Dean Everett M. Baker, Dean of Students at MIT, His Excellency Paul A. Deva, Governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Dr. James R. Killian, Jr., who on Saturday will be inaugurated as the 10th President of MIT, Mr. Churchill, Dr. Compton, the Honorable Bernard Baruch, Dean Eli Burchard, Dean of Humanities and Chairman of the Convocation.
We are honored by and grateful to President Harold E. Stassen of the University of Pennsylvania, who on short notice has very generously agreed to deliver the address on this closing session of the MIT Mid-Century Convocation. With his distinguished career, we are all familiar. May I therefore give this introduction a personal note. Through my relatives in Minnesota, I had heard his praises sung from the time he was first elected governor of that state in 1939, the youngest governor in the history of Minnesota, and at that time, the youngest in the United States. His wise and courageous administration won him two successive re-elections, but he resigned in his third term to enter the United States Navy. In late January 1944, I was first privileged to meet Captain Stassen in Noumea, New Caledonia, where he was serving on the staff of Admiral Halsey as flag officer. I was impressed by the unobtrusive yet efficient manner in which he handled the arrangements for a distinguished group of officers from the Southwest Pacific and the South Pacific areas who were on their way to a joint staff conference in Pearl Harbor. I next met Dr. Stassen immediately after the war in a series of informal meetings of a small group assembled under the auspices of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. This group undertook an analysis of the possibilities and requirements for the handling of the newly developed atomic power in the interest of international peace. These studies were turned over to the Acheson Committee of the State Department when it was formed. And the results of both studies were in turn passed on as preliminary material to assist the Atomic Energy Commission of the United Nations when it was established to grapple with this problem under the leadership of our distinguished friend on this platform, Mr. Baruch. An effective administrator, a leader of American liberal thought, but with the word liberal understood in what I believe to be its true sense, and that described last night by Mr. Churchill with a small L. Dr. Stassen has joined the fraternity of those who see in education a great opportunity to construct for the future a better America and a better world. Dr. Harold E. Stassen, President of the University of Pennsylvania.
Dr. Compton, Honorable Winston Churchill, President Killian, distinguished guests, my fellow citizens. Although I appear tonight, as you know, as an 11th hour substitute for the President, I assume it is totally unnecessary for me to tell you, with a smile, that I do not speak for him. That I do not speak for him, and that he is not responsible for anything I say this evening. I am certain, nevertheless, that I can speak for the President and for this vast audience and for the people of our country, when I give a salute to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology for its amazing record of constructive educational and scientific accomplishment, and say best wishes and Godspeed to this great institution and to its able, modest new president, Dr. James Killian. And I am supremely confident that in the same representative manner, I may word a hearty and respectful welcome to these shores, to that gifted and inspiring leader of the people of Britain in their finest hour, that contemporary Shakespeare, Burke, and Nelson cast in one dramatic mold, the Honorable Winston Churchill. Speak of the future, that I address my remarks toward the second half of this 20th century, which so shortly will begin. Now let me respond that I am not given to prediction, and not even to shorter range prediction. especially not after what happened on November 2nd, 1948. Yet seriously, I do recognize with you the importance of thinking ahead. I agree that at the mid-turn of a century, in this atmosphere of science, a searching inquiry into the humanities is important. I agree that the next 50 years is not too long a time to think about when we reflect that barring catastrophe, most of the undergraduates of MIT and the other millions of our youth now engaged in study will witness during their lifetimes this full half century of which we speak. There are those who will say, why speak of half a century when within a few years we either solve the whole worldwide question of relations of men or see civilization die in the rubble of an atomic war. Others whisper that atomic destruction, with all its horrors, is but as a bow and arrow compared to the potential devastation of germ warfare. And still others say, and that is not all. No one is more keenly aware than I am of the vast capacity for catastrophe possessed by future war, or more determined that mankind must find the way to prevent its occurrence. Yet I here declare that to say now that all thinking should begin and end upon this question of the prevention of a third world war is to introduce a note of sterility into our analysis. It is to shackle our minds at the very moment in history when it is most essential that they be unfettered. I therefore state, in considered phrases, that if, God forbid, an atomic war does come, civilization will survive. If more than one future world war should come, with all the destructive force of every kind that is developed, civilization will yet survive. I say this bluntly, for I believe that the future course of man requires that there be a toughness of free minds, a searching long-term thought upon future policy, a complete canvas of considered alternatives, and no blind spots or roadblocks in our thinking. Terrible devastation and destruction and suffering can be dealt out, but in my judgment, man can never fashion the means of destroying all men. Man can never wipe out entirely throughout the world that curious combination of progress called civilization. Our first concern is not to be for places to hide. Our approach should not be one of either hysteria or resignation. Rather, must we be determined that we will win through for freedom, that we will rebuild, we will go on, whate'er may come. And before... before turning our eyes to the future, we gain perspective if we recall that when this century began 50 years ago, man had never flown. The first feeble, fascinating flight by Orville Wright occurred in 1903. Man, at the turn of the century, moved heavily over land and slowly over sea. Thus handicapped, food moved with difficulty. Lands were tilled laboriously. In the first decade of this century, many, many millions of peoples died of starvation and of plagues. I need not speak of today's non-stop refueled aerial circling of the world, of many flights at speeds above 500 miles an hour, of some faster than sound, of communication by radio covering the globe every day, of the rapid increase in the transmission of visual messages via television, of production, mass production, and its amazing totals, of medical science and its conquest of major epidemics. What then of the future? Should we not contemplate, as a minimum, readily available non-stop travel to any point in the world, communication of message and of picture everywhere, and new developed sources of energy, removing old limitations of fuel and of transport. Clearly, the physical facts today, and in increasing degree, the projection of these facts, must be worldwide. And our thinking must give more consideration than ever before to the fundamental nature of man and the way in which he should live. This philosophic approach has greater validity than either an economic, social, military, or political approach, for it affects all these and more too. I talk of worldwide fundamental concepts with humility, with hesitation, but I do hope that I may in some degree stimulate and provoke others through disagreement and agreement, through modification and amendment, through correction and projection, to contribute a larger measure to the unending dynamic process of thinking our way through to the course we should follow. It is my view that there are in the world three major streams of philosophic thought as to the nature of man and the way in which he should live. Each is many centuries old. None is held purely and completely by any numerically appreciable group of the people on the earth. Each has felt the cross impact of the other. Each has received impetus, direction, modification from geographic and anthropological fact, from experience and circumstances, from scholarship, and from religion. The correct evaluation of these three streams and the appropriate development of policies at home and abroad are of greater importance for the next half century than any other intellectual pursuits. These are the three. The concept of the natural rights of man, that he was meant to be free, of his inherent worth and dignity, of his spiritual quality, of his relationship to God, and of his brotherhood to fellow man. The concept of the subordinate status of man to man, of his possessing rights only as they are given to him by those in command of the society in which he lives, of might making right, of man's value limited to his material being, with no recognition of his spiritual value and no God. The concept of man's little worth, indifference to his rights and welfare, of mystical and primary concern for the hereafter, of life as a vale of tears or a period of suffering, of devotion to a rigid religion and callousness to the conditions of living. These three might be termed the doctrines of the free and equal man, of the subservient and atheistic man, and of the apathetic and lowly man. Or they might be labeled the concepts of liberty of man, order for man, and indifference to man. Each has a diverse and ancient background. None is held and implemented concisely and completely by any peoples. There are some shreds of evidence of the welling up of the first stream of natural rights in the misty glimpses of the earliest history of civilization, when the workers on the pyramids and on the drainage projects of the ancient Nile Valley demanded that not only Pharaoh's court, but the workers too were entitled to the right to worship Ra, the sun god, and receive the benefits therefrom, rather than to be limited to the worship of Osiris, god of the earth and underground. In any event, the flow is clearly evident when we come to ancient Athens, in the writings of Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, with their unfolding views of justice and of law. It is given major impetus by Christianity, in some respects by Judaism, and traces its development to the constitutionalism of ancient Rome, to Magna Carta, to Locke, to the founders of our own United States, to the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, to Jefferson, and to Lincoln. This philosophy of the nature of man, as you recognize, has had predominant influence upon the governmental, economic, and social systems of the Western civilization, of nearly all the nations of Europe, of the British Commonwealth of Nations, of the United States of America, and has had a considerable impact in all other portions of the world. The second stream, that of materialism and force, is noted in part in the Sophists and Epicureans of ancient Greece, and is traced through the 17th century French materialists, through Hobbes, through Hegel and Feuerbach of Germany, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, Lenin, Hitler, and Stalin. It is of import now in the ruling groups in Russia and her satellites, in Spain and Portugal and Argentina, and in the north of China. The third stream, that of indifference, springs from the earliest Eastern religions. And although in their theology they place high value on the life of man, yet the extreme mysticism and aesthetic emphasis of the beauty of a spiritual hereafter, when coupled with the poverty and want of overcrowded destitution, causes the principal current religions of Asia and the East, Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and Mohammedanism, to contribute largely to this stream. This philosophy, as you recognize, is of key significance in all of Asia, including China, Burma, India, Malaya, Pakistan, and also in Africa. I recognize that a question may arise as to relating Hitler and Stalin, Nazism and communism, to the same philosophic stream. But I reply that the attitudes in both instances toward the nature of man and his rights are closely identified, that the bitter clashes in doctrinal statement and the war between them rose from their proximity to each other as major mutually suspicious powers rather than from any fundamental ideological difference, and that the furor principle of Hitler's system and the centralism of Stalin's system and the whole approach of ruthless domination and cold-blooded liquidation of those with whom they differed were of the same cloth. Some may also question the inclusion of Hindu and Muslim, bitter in their clash with each other, in the third category together. But their fanatic hostility toward each other is confirmation of the mystic and rigid beliefs and callousness toward mortal life, rather than a negation of it. I say to you tonight, I have a deep and abiding faith that the first stream of philosophic thought, that of inherent right of liberty, is correct as to the nature of man. I believe it points the way for policy and for action in the confusion and clash which have arisen so soon and so sharp in the wake of World War II. I am confident it can be the basis for winning through toward the true objectives of mankind. It presents laws as true universally for all men, as are the laws of physical science, which we know are valid, even though many men do not recognize or believe them. We should understand its own dynamic living qualities, and our constant effort should be to improve the implementation of that philosophy in economic and social and political systems, and endeavor unceasingly and skillfully and by peaceful means to increase the adherence to it in the other portions of the world. We should further seek to improve our system with the aid of the constructive value of the bitter criticism of its economic and social shortcomings made by those who hold the opposing materialistic philosophy. And finally, we ought to enrich our doctrine by the more highly developed sense of beauty and by a measure of the tranquility of those who hold the concept of mystical indifference. In applying our broad theory to specific hard problems in definite terms, there may be many here tonight who, though they have traveled with me thus far, will part company with me on specific suggestions. Nevertheless, broad generalizations are of little value unless we give them this specific application through proposals for definite actions in the problems that are before us. If my analysis of the major stream of philosophic view motivating the communist leadership of Russia and her satellites is correct, then it definitely indicates that their appraisal of relative force will be the key influence restraining or encouraging their aggression. Holding as a fundamental idea the denial of any higher concept of justice or morality, they believe that someone will rule by force, and from their standpoint, it had better be them. This means, in turn, that no voluntary release of power over others can be anticipated, no voluntary yielding of human rights, no granting of freedoms, unless compelled by the pressure of internal or external, impending or applied force. Relating this inescapable situation to the specific China problem, we must conclude that by our inaction and by our withdrawal of aid, we are foolhardy to thus contribute to the communist domination of China. We should move, and move promptly, to bolster the southern half of China. To assist, by materials and by counsel, in maintaining the independence of Canton and of the four southern provinces of Guangdong, Guangxi, Fujian, Hunan, and of Formosa and Hong Kong, and giving due consideration to European needs and to our own total economic situation and capacity, we should regularly invest a portion of our resources in Asia for the resistance to communism. The amount should be a minimum, as I see it now, of $1 billion a year. It should be administered on an Asia-wide approach. I'm not proposing a China program, Japan program, Burma program, an Asia-wide approach. Preferably in relation to local provinces and individual projects and in underwriting private endeavor rather than being funneled through any central major government. Clearly, the Marshall Plan in Europe has been the most significant single right thing we have done since the end of the war. And as you know, I supported that from its very beginning and before that. And I say tonight, it is high time that we have a parallel American MacArthur plan in Asia. Supported in a major way. It should be long-term in its vision, adjusted to Oriental conditions, continuous in its execution, carrying the same flexibility of detailed application and the same high concept of objectives and requirement of self-help as the Marshall Plan. If we are further right in our philosophic view, then it follows that men everywhere have the right to know the facts and information and ideas from other parts of the world. An individual can pull down a curtain for his own privacy, but no ruler has the right to drop a curtain and close off men from communication with their fellow men. And that, sir, was the great principle, one of the great principles of the speech of Fulton. The program represented by the Voice of America, therefore, should be greatly expanded and ingeniously modified. Not only messages by radio, but in addition, the widespread dissemination of printed literature, giving facts and information and ideas, should be carried forth. I am informed by men who know, who have the technical competence, that such literature can with comparative ease be scattered broadcast over closed borders by means of drifting balloons or from high-flying aeroplanes during favorable winds. There needs to be a continuous, widespread, dramatic program of printed messages from free men to all mankind. You know, in fact, one of my friends suggested that dropping a few Sears Roebuck catalogs should be included in the literature from the sky. Of course, we're actually discussing messages and literature of much wider significance than that of consumer goods production. I am proposing that we vigorously contest for the minds of men everywhere. And if methods such as these of sending material over borders seem contrary to ancient rules of diplomatic respect for borders, let me emphasize that when officials of governments constantly pour out vitriolic attacks on free peoples, and that's all they pour out to their own people, the remedy is not that of trying to block their free speech. The remedy is not infringement upon the right of assembly to hear this party line, whether it be in New York or Newark, within free countries. Rather, our doctrine indicates that the response should be wide dissemination of information. The peoples in Russia and the satellite countries should be continuously told of our views and intentions, and firmness and objectives, of our desires for peace, of the facts of the rest of the world. We should apply for support from the minds of the peoples in these dictatorially governed nations. The internal pressures for freedom and for peace that will come from a well-informed people within these countries can be just as important as the deterrent of our own potential counteracting military force that is available in the event of war. These are times without parallel. And we must ingeniously develop a way in which to carry on the contest of ideas. Winning that contest will be the best assurance that there need not be a grim struggle by military force. Some men have turned to materialism at a number of points in history when faced with widespread abuses which denied in practice the philosophy of liberty and equality which was professed. The present sway of this coercive materialistic concept is directly traceable to reaction against the autocracy of the czars, to the monopolies and unfairness to labor in early capitalism, to the neglect of the responsibility of brotherhood by our West after World War I. Above all, its present extent has been due to the cruel measures of force used by those cold calculators who seized power under its doctrine. Throughout recorded history, men, after listening to the exponents of this philosophy of order dictated over humanity, have repeatedly rejected it in their minds and struggled on for more individual liberty. I say the plain people will reject it again. They will reject it in Russia. They will reject it in Eastern Europe if we but give them the chance by pursuing dynamic humanitarian policies, by sending them the facts, by maintaining alert and adequate military strength, and by never surrendering through the jelly-like course of appeasement. Of marked interest in this whole sphere has been the recent conduct of peoples dominated by the third stream of indifference, and their rapid response to any ray of hope of better life on Earth. The favorable change in Turkey and in the Philippines are recent confirmations of this. Thus, I'm encouraged to say that the story of man gives renewed and deeper faith in the inherent truth of our philosophy of the native worth of man, that he was meant to be free upon this globe. Now, it's likewise imperative that we improve the application of our own philosophy to our own social, economic, and political systems. Certainly, the violations of civil rights, the discriminations and repressions of bigotry, which are too numerous in our country, are directly contrary to the philosophy to which we subscribe. There must be a steady insistence upon progress in this respect. It would be tragic if this session of Congress adjourned without at least passing the anti-lynch and anti-poll tax measures. Major progress must be made in this direction with regard for those portions of our population which have suffered discrimination in their opportunities for education, for facilities of better health, and for decent housing. Our concept of the nature of man is further guidance, though in a very different manner, in our economic and social policy. It means that those policies, taken as a whole, should contribute to the rounded development, the creative capacity, the worthwhile character, and the true happiness of man. The objectives of our economic policies, therefore, must not be limited by the materialistic principle of meeting to the maximum degree the physical wants of man. It is undoubtedly true that if government were to take over the distribution of all the food of the nation, at least in theory, it could deliver a packaged assigned amount of food to every household every day at less expense than now involved. It's equally true in theory that if government took over the distribution of all the clothing of the country, in theory, it could deliver to every person every year allocated clothing at less expense than clothing now costs. The same observation could be applied to other necessities of life. Well, let me make it clear that from a strictly material approach, I believe that the result of such an attempt would in fact be the loss of interest in production, lower supplies, and the failure to attain the material utopia outlined. But entirely apart from the question of the successful production of material returns, do you not agree that removing from the individual both the privilege and the responsibility of planning for the provision of necessities, of making choices, of budgeting earnings, of weighing relativities, would result in the end in a people of less resourcefulness, less value of personality, less happiness, less strength of character? Thus, I feel the economic socialist... Thus, I feel the economic socialists are departing from the basic philosophic stream in which we would move. Their concentration upon attempted material service to the many, with disregard for the individual rights and opportunities of the few who are especially talented in various fields, negates the basic tenets of our way of life. The concept of the natural rights of each man must give rise to a constitutional system that protects man against oppression by the tyrannical rule of a single ruler, or by a clique of rulers, or by an unbridled majority itself. Is it not clear that each aspect of the system should serve the many and the few. It should yield dividends in standards of living, in education, and enjoyment to the many. But it should also keep open the avenues of opportunity for the few who stand out in each category. Such a system should safeguard minorities of whatever kind, and more particularly should be so constituted as to keep open the road for the talented few to develop and use their unusual talents. If under the impetus of a short-sighted response to numbers in a democracy, or in a revolt against the oppression of rulers, economic, social, and political systems are directed only toward fruits for the many, the result will be a deteriorating mess of mediocrity. The great artist, the inventor, the skilled surgeon, the exceptional scientist, the ingenious engineer, the keen financier, the gifted production manager, the designer, the craftsman, the scholar, each should find his path blocked by no insurmountable artificial obstacles, no excessive man-made handicaps, and each should have before him the fullest of incentives. The unfolding genius of each of these in a desirable system will in turn yield great dividends to the many, yes, to all. The general attitude of the economic total socialist of bringing it to the people can clearly be overdone. As Toynbee reports, all of history shows that civilizations may deteriorate or abort or ossify when they meet enervating, dissipating conditions or when they encounter adversity too extreme to surmount. There's every indication from the ancient Egyptian civilization of 6,000 years ago down to modern Western civilization that a challenge of sufficient nature, but not obliterating in its weight, leads to the most significant development and response. Do not the studies of individual human nature indicate a similar rule? The capacities, of course, are varied. But in relationship to potentiality, a challenge of some adversity and stimulus, not stifling in amount, develops stronger personality, a happier individual, than does either crushed subservience or blissful lassitude. To me, this means that attempts to establish a breakfast-in-bed economy for the citizens is a sad mistake both for the people and for the nation. Our unending effort should be to ease those overwhelming burdens which are beyond the capacity of individual man to bear. But we must leave the major normal provision for man's own livelihood and future up to him himself. In our economic relationships with those who are of the third major conceptual stream, that of indifference and mysticism, we should seek to stimulate and to contribute toward the improvement of the very low standards of living in these areas, and at the same time to demonstrate and lead toward a higher appraisal of human life. Too often has the Western world been willing to profit by that low appraisal of native human life in the exploitation of colonial resources instead of demonstrating a higher value for life. You know, there's a small grain of truth in the fictional story of the American investor in dependent area resources who plaintively exclaimed, "I'm perfectly willing to educate my native workers, but I am afraid that the first lesson learned will be to demand a raise in wages." The Dutch in the East Indies, the French in Indochina, are at this time particularly subject to censure for exploitation practices. All of us need to think through our basic policy in dependent areas in the Near East, in Africa, and in Asia, and harmonize those policies with our fundamental doctrine of the nature of man. A greater portion of the returns from the resources of these territories should be retained there for direct and constructive purpose, utilizing the superb experience of Western civilization for the advancement of the native peoples, for their education, their health, for increase of their production of goods and of the general raising of their standards of living. You will note I've listed education as the first of the various contributions which I urge toward these dependent peoples. I know that some will say, pointing to the near starvation of many millions in Asia, that food sufficient to place them above the miserable subsistence level, should have top and almost exclusive priority. But I submit that if only the supply of food is raised, without an advance in education in its broadest cultural sense, without instilling a higher morality, and without an elevated, emancipated status for women, the only result of more food will be a larger population to exist at the same level of destitution and misery. If man is to make a significant ascent, the cultural, educational, ethical side must be lifted at the same time that the food and material production totals are increased. This requires the development by Western nations, with the aid of the trusteeship portions of the United Nations Charter, of a worldwide code of conduct for capital abroad. And excessive risks for this capital must at the same time be underwritten by society as a whole to remove the need or excuse for excessive profit and exploitation. In a very brief space of time, there have come major indications of an amazing development flowing out of the independence of Israel, not only affecting the growth of resources and advancing conditions of living, not only in the new nation, but in addition causing a constructive stirring in neighboring Arab states. But someone could well say that there cannot be a bright prospect for world peace, whatever happens in these issues and programs we've been discussing, and for progress of mankind, unless a mechanism of government is developed on a world level to administer the natural rights of man, to adjudicate differences between peoples, to stabilize and police world situations. And of course, this objection is right, and it is constructive to urge this necessity. But as we analyze the three philosophies I've described, it must appear crystal clear that no major portion of the world that follows the materialistic concept of the nature of man can be included or will permit itself to be included in a world administrative machinery unless that apparatus be one dominated by a concept of force. Furthermore, in all major component parts, there is the concept, unless there is that concept, of a higher justice, of natural rights of man, with the self-restraint and the self-discipline that comes with it. It's difficult to see how a world structure for administration over all men can be successfully maintained, unless there is that foundation developed. This means that we had better develop the lesser agencies and commissions and courts and arbitration systems, and the regional approach, in the Atlantic community, in Europe, in the broader community of those who move in our philosophic stream, and make an effort to expand this similar concept to other parts of the world. And as a part of this growth, we should note the vital necessity for a currency or medium of exchange, which with reasonable speed and stable convertibility can be the helpful agent for the movement of goods and services between peoples. There must be unceasing concentration upon this major task in the Atlantic community and beyond. It may well be found, with the internal problems that exist as to all national currencies, that an impelling need exists for the establishment of a Bank of the Atlantic. Such a Bank of the Atlantic may well find that it needs to issue an appropriate currency backed in part by gold, available for those many circumstances in which direct exchange of national currencies is no longer feasible. The United Nations Charter has within itself the means for strengthening and developing its provisions in all essential respects on the world level. Our government and other governments should appoint commissions to address themselves to the many complicated and difficult problems that will be involved in establishing a minimum of effective government at a future time at a world level. Obviously, in its present form, riddled with vetoes, weakened by lack of police power, the United Nations is sadly inadequate to meet its own high purposes. But I would nevertheless caution that we must not underestimate its value, even in its present weak form. Without such an organization, limited though it be, so clear an understanding of the devious and distorted and dangerous policies of the Politburo of Russia could not have been acquired so quickly by the overwhelming majorities of the peoples of the world. That's a result of the town hall of the world. Without it, economic recovery from the damage of war could not have moved forward as rapidly as it has. Without it, Israel today would not be a free and developing state substantially at peace. Without it, we already would have lost the lingering hope of peace with freedom and justice on the earth. Each session of the United Nations and of its committees and bodies should be looked upon as an opportunity for a serious, thoughtful, informative discussion of these subjects. And clearly, our whole education in the years ahead must convey to our youth an understanding of each of these philosophies, of their manifestations, their meanings, their mechanisms. This can best occur through the development of general education conducted with true academic freedom. We should not attempt to indoctrinate our youth with narrow zeal for America as it is, but rather to open the avenues for personal growth, develop the broad understanding of our basic concepts, instill a deep appreciation of the progress our country has made in relationship to those truths and of the progress others have made, and encourage a determination to use the avenues of peaceful change through democracy for constantly improving our America and the lot of all mankind. On that road lies for our youth the non-corroding, intelligent, effective, satisfying love of America, which we all want our young men and young women to possess. Ladies and gentlemen, of course we have not attained the ideals marked out by this warm humanitarian philosophy. For true ideals springing from a great philosophy are like the stars in the heavens. You cannot ever reach them with your hands, but if you understand them and see their location, they will guide you aright. Such ideals are as valuable as aids to navigation through the social, economic, and political troubles of the day, as are the stars in the heavens for navigation over the sea or through the air or across the desert. As Browning wrote, so optimistically, so beautifully, "Ah, but a man's reach should exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for?" We seek for mankind a better life, a more fruitful life, a happier life. An ever deeper understanding of our dynamic philosophy of life with an unending determination and unfaltering courage to apply it can lead, yes, I believe will lead, to a brilliant half century now opening before mankind.
President Stassen, we are very grateful to you for bringing to us in this closing session of our convocation such a message of optimism and inspiration. For you have given us some great challenges. You have set us some great goals. And to men of courage and goodwill, a challenge and a goal is an inspiration to accomplishment. We thank you very much. And now I'm going to call on two of my associates to express the feelings of appreciation on the part of our student body and of our administration to the great statesman from overseas who has visited us on this occasion. I'll call first on Mr. Kirshner for a presentation from our student body, and then on President Killian for a presentation from our administration.
Churchill, the students of MIT would like to extend to you an expression of goodwill and fellowship as a participant in our mid-century convocation. In commemoration of this event, a golden key has been specially poured, bearing the likeness of our MIT beaver. So on behalf of the Undergraduate Subcommittee for the Convocation and the MIT Student Body, I should like to extend this gold key to you, sir, in remembrance of an occasion which to us will always have a deep and lasting significance.
Churchill, you have made a scholarly contribution to the MIT convocation. More by your moral force and by your eloquence, you have lifted up our hearts. We are precluded by policy at MIT from awarding honorary degrees. Instead, we would like to invite Mr. Churchill to be an honorary member of the Company of Scholars, which is MIT. Mr. Churchill, this appointment as honorary lecturer involves no responsibilities or no duties on your part, save one that you permitted to remind you for all time of our delight in having you here and of our appreciation for your contribution to the convocation. And now may I read the appointment itself. The Corporation of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology hereby appoints as honorary lecturer Winston Spencer Churchill, warrior, statesman, student, and maker of history. Defender of democracy, who in two wars has steadily upheld the cause of the free people, and who in his finest hour so behaved that his name stands engrossed on the tablets of mankind as the 20th century symbol of resistance to oppression. Mr. Churchill, may I present this appointment to you?
Ladies and gentlemen, I am off duty tonight. My task was accomplished as well as it lay in my power last night. And tonight I am to receive and have received kindly tokens that at any rate all friendly relations were not at an end. I have listened with very great pleasure to the thoughtful and powerful address to which we have listened from President Stass. And I cannot conceal from you that I found myself in agreement with it on very many points of substance and on almost all points of sentiment. Now, on this occasion, I have to thank you for two gifts, two presentations which I value very greatly. The first is that I am an honorary lecturer of MIT, which means that I can come here whenever I choose and lecture you on any matter which may excite my interest. On this occasion, I have to thank you for two gifts, two presentations which I value very greatly. The first is that I am an honorary lecturer of MIT, which means that I can come here whenever I choose and lecture you on any matter which may excite my interest. The second is the presentation to me from the students' body by Mr. Kirchner of this golden key. May it always be the means of giving me the feeling and the faith that I have the key to American hearts. Should be so, and if I may feel that in our own small island across the ocean we have reached conclusions which are in broad harmony with those of the great republic, we may indeed face the future with confidence and with hope. And for my part, I have the strongest feelings of gratitude for all the manifestations of kindliness and friendship which I have received. I carry away from this great gathering sentiments which will enable me for the rest of my life to view in a totally different light the Boston Tea Party of which I heard in my... And let me hear, express from the bottom of my heart, the gratitude of the British people to the valiant, generous people of the United States for all the part that they are playing in the future world. And let me give my assurance to this great audience, one of the finest I have ever addressed, that without their aid, without their guidance and strength, all the struggles that our soldiers and sailors have made in the war might well be cast away, but that persistency along the lines which they have adopted will carry us, may well carry us, through the dangers which lie ahead and may possibly avert from humanity the fearful curse of another war. I thank you all for the kindness which you have shown me. I don't need a microphone to tell you, how deep and great is my regard for my motherland. And I will carry an inspiration from this great gathering back to Britain. And I trust indeed that we may continue to march shoulder to shoulder along the path of truth, of justice, and of honor. I shouldn't like to leave here without listening to United States Marines, if I may.
With your permission.
This final general assembly of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology mid-century convocation. The principal address at this final general assembly was delivered by Dr. Harold E. Stassen, the president of the University of Pennsylvania. In addition, Mr. Churchill was presented an honorary lectureship from MIT, as well as a token of remembrance from the student body of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. From Boston Garden in Boston, Massachusetts, we have brought you these ceremonies attendant upon this, the final general assembly of the mid-century convocation of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We return you now to the studio.
This is WHDH in Boston. A brief recorded interlude with the music of Eric Coates, the National Symphony.